I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're alive in a moment of what feels like revolution. Not the first, and maybe not the last, in the perfectly amazing national election year of 2016. What we're feeling, almost hearing, is the thunder of a monumental dam breaking, an ancient but very modern and American tradition of guys in charge, a perfect skein of 44 male presidents of the United States since George Washington in 1789. We're hearing a sort of death of male privilege by self-caricature in the Republican nominee for President Donald J. Trump. It's no moment for prediction or judgment of history, which is, after all, an argument that never ends. We're listening this hour with as many ears as we can with a variety of women. First, the First Lady of the Nation, Michelle Obama, today at a Hillary Clinton rally in Manchester, New Hampshire.
This is not something that we can ignore. It's not something we can just sweep under the rug as just another disturbing footnote in a sad election season. Because this was not just a lewd conversation. This wasn't just locker room banter. This was a powerful individual speaking freely and openly about sexually predatory behavior and actually bragging about kissing and groping women, using language so obscene that many of us were worried about our children hearing it when we turn on the TV. And I have to tell you that I listen to all of this and I feel it so personally. The shameful comments about our bodies, the disrespect of our ambitions and intellect, the belief that you can do anything you want to a woman. It is cruel. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts. It hurts.
There's a lot of pain in that voice and a lot of feeling beyond words. But let's give it a try. Wendy Kaminer, get our live conversation started. Wendy Kaminer, lawyer, civil libertarian, feminist, free speech champion, skeptic, often contrarian. In the maelstrom, Wendy, what are you thinking?
The agitation in her voice is remarkable. I understand it. I relate to it. Just about every woman I know has experienced some kind of harassment, some kind of condescension from men, some loss because of their sex. So I understand it. At the same time, I don't entirely share it, partly because I know how far we've come, because I'm old enough to remember when want ads were divided into columns for male and female jobs. Mm. And I expect progress to be slow. We're also
so does Michelle.
And so does Michelle.
She's come a long way.
Yes, she has, absolutely. And we are, and of course, Trump's behavior plays right into the very strong, intense concern these days about what's called rape culture. You know, he exemplifies for many people rape culture. I am wary of this rape culture meme because I think it tends to elide the distinctions between groping and serious violent assaults. I think it tends to encourage women to feel traumatized by even relatively minor unwelcome sexual contacts. So it's, you know, as you say, it's complicated. We look at what's going on campus right now around sexual assaults and the lack of due process for men who are accused of assault. We look at this notion that we're supposed to believe women whenever they allege sexual assaults without even really examining their claims. It's complicated because at the same time, we know that historically, women have categorically been disbelieved when they allege sexual assault. And we know that, of course, we've never had a female president. You know, I am wary of identity politics, but I remember back in, I guess it was 1984, when Mondale unexpectedly named Jerry Ferrara as his vice president. And I can remember where I was when I heard that. And I can remember the feeling of, not liberation, but movement. I remember the feeling of dramatic movement because we had a woman who was going to be a vice presidential nominee on a major ticket. So I understand that. At the same time, I'm wary of it.
I want to introduce a woman who ran on a minor ticket, her own, Eileen Miles. Earlier today, we heard the charged power of a breakthrough in her voice. She's a poet we love, cult writer turned icon in the video series Transparent. Sounding today, ever, as always, like a girl from the neighborhood, Arlington, Massachusetts, Eileen Miles.
This is my job as a poet to try and unpack language. But the thing I wish she did on the debate, when he repeated twice that that's just locker room banter, I want to talk about what locker room banter is, because as far as I'm concerned, that's just another name for patriarchy. The way I understand locker room banter is that that is kind of a reinstatement of the values that made there be private men's clubs and golf clubs and drinking clubs and bars all over America. I mean, that just ended in the 60s and 70s, where there were so many private clubs for men, where they did business, where they probably brought sex workers, where they made plans, all sorts of things that inherently reestablish men's power and exclude women. I don't know, kind of create sort of language and propaganda for sexual abuse and assault and all sorts of things that are negatives towards women. I mean, like, locker room banter to me just is another way of saying that there are private men's clubs from where we rule the world and our language is sacred. He was trying to have it both ways. It's just locker room banter and then it's just words. But as we know, so are legal contracts. So are all kinds of verbal abuse. But I mean, I think basically he's just saying that men have a right to have a place where they rule the world and abuse women verbally and then set out refreshed from that experience of being in that sauna of, you know, hierarchical sexual potency to go and act on it. He was just brushing off the absolute omnipotence of the male gender.
What can women do with this opportunity, do you think, to redefine exactly that question of privilege, but also really of equality?
I think we have to all struggle to be more awake all the time so that when we hear such, you know, garbage, we're sort of on our toes to say, wait a second, what do you mean? I mean, like, I always have to remember to say, what do you mean? Because if he had to say what he meant about locker room banter, he would be back in the first debate. He would say more stupid things. It's like every time we allow somebody to use some kind of euphemism for something really horrendous and ugly, they have to play their card. I mean, because I think part of the thing that's so wrong with this election is that there's been so much sexism and there's so much negation at the exact same moment of the fact that that's what's going on. The worst part of this system of patriarchy is that we have to pretend that the emperor has clothes on, that the elephant is not in the room. You know, we have to kind of always go along with presence and pretend that it's absent because that's the deal.
Eileen Miles, I want to just thank you, and especially on the point that we've all got to wake up every day. Thoreau said, have you ever met anybody who's really awake? It's impossible, but we've got to keep striving.
The very fact of this election, the very fact that we have these two candidates, the most ludicrous example of masculinity opposed to the first viable female president, makes me see once again that America has never been a tragic nation and is always a comic nation. I mean, I think we experience all our feelings through ludicrousness and comedy. So it's kind of like we have the woman playing the straight man to the buffoonish man, and an awful lot of guys and some women in America are pleased by his performance. But I think on the other hand, we get lots of people saying, yeah, well, it's great that a woman is almost going to get elected, but she's the wrong woman. I mean, all the things that brought her to this position make her be the woman. You know, whether it's generationalism or sexism, it seems to be just another expression of the core difficulty in allowing a woman to sit in a seat of power in America. I mean, I think we are a dying empire, but I think that there's something so fabulous about the thought of a woman sitting at the Oval Office. It's such a moment of such collective impossibility and derangement and devastation. I mean, like, America's a mess right now. And, like, let's have a woman take charge and see what happens.
That was Eileen Miles. What was the Onion headline?
The Onion headline when Obama was elected was, "Black man gets worse job in America."
Now let's give it to a woman.
Right. Now let's give it to a woman that we might even be more messed up.
One of the important things here for me, Donald Trump, let's face it, is going to be the all-time poster boy for rape culture and its disguises, its excuses, its, you know, show me, et cetera. The line, "It's just words, you know, I didn't do any of it, so therefore it's okay," or something. The barrier between words and action and power has been erased.
And I think that's a huge problem. I am very troubled by this notion that there's something called verbal conduct, which we can regulate, which we can prohibit, which we can criminalize. Whenever people want to censor speech, they call it verbal conduct. I mean, we see this all the time now on college campuses. We see it off campus generally. Whenever people talk about regulating whatever it is that they consider hate speech, they call it verbal conduct. Mm. Now, the Trump example is a little different because he was actually describing what he said was his own behavior. And in a way, he erased the line between words and actions by saying, "This is what I like to do to women." But someone suggested to me today that his statement by itself should be actionable. And I thought, that is a ridiculous and very troubling notion, because his statement by itself can only be actionable if we want to make bragging illegal. And I don't think we want to do that.
Not yet. Wendy, before we're done, we've got to approach this question, a certain uneasiness about a rush to judgment, a mob consensus crystallized in a week, maybe a stampede, and rights that are not to be honored in this context. But we'll be back. Coming up, Maura Weigel, emergent writer, literature scholar from Yale, and the Pakistani-American and Muslim activist and author, Rafia Zakaria, speaking about the multiplicity of awakenings underway. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Taking fresh impressions of a sweeping upheaval of votes, opinions, feelings, catalyzed by the long year of Donald Trump, and now suddenly crystallizing. Maura Weigel is getting a PhD in literature at Yale as she makes her own nonfiction career in commentary on women in America. Her book is Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. Define the victory, Maura Weigel. Define the reservations.
The victory for the
culture, the sensibility around rape culture and being aware of it.
Yeah, well, I think it's tricky. I mean, it was interesting listening to the previous guest speak, because I also—
Wendy, she's still here.
Wendy, I also watched the Michelle Obama talk today, and I felt very moved. It's sort of, I think, watching the last debate, watching Obama, Michelle Obama, I just felt this sad, sickening feeling that I've discussed with so many of my friends. And I think, you know, there are a lot of complicated issues at stake that you've been raising. But I do think it's hard to get around sort of the ugliness and violence of that speech. And it's not merely private speech, I would argue, because it's— he uses misogynistic comments. He uses abusive comments towards women to sort of rally up his base in a political context. I was fascinated by what Eileen Miles said, because I'm fascinated by the locker room talk phrase. It strikes me that it's almost this fantasy of the locker room as sort of the safe space for white men or something. It's like the space where you're allowed to say all the terrible things that you're not supposed to say. It feels very much part of what I think of as the paranoid imagination of political correctness, where there's this army of women or minorities who are coming to hound you down, if you just call it like it is. So I don't know. It seemed to me it was so affecting because so many of us have experienced this kind of shameful comment or certain kinds of assault or violence. And it's not that we want to inhabit the position of victimhood. That itself is also discouraging to see sort of Mitt Romney and other conservatives lining up to sort of say, hey, no, women are victims. We need to protect them. I mean, that's not the feminism we want. But I think there is something very visceral about that kind of frank claiming of male privilege under this mantle of paranoia that, you know, they're just in the locker room. They need their safe space.
Can I throw in a thought, a double thought? One, we believe in safe spaces. How often do we say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas? And I've never been to Vegas, but there are places that you want to be yourself or whatever it is on anything. The contrary notion, though, is that Billy Bush is the not only the fall guy, but he's in a certain way the villain. He's the guy who encouraged that man to talk on and on and on in this vein and never said, wait a sec, I'm getting off the bus. This is not decent speech.
There are very few people.
Wendy Kaminer.
There are very few people who, in a circumstance like that, will stand up to someone who's in a position of greater power.
And yet, shame on us is
part
of the lesson.
Yes, but there are very few people who will do that. We also have no reason to believe that Billy Bush actually objected to what Trump was saying. But that's why the advice that you will hear from consultants on rape culture, on how to deal with people who are engaging in this kind of speech is, oh, well, just change the subject. Find a non-aggressive way of intervening where you don't have to stand up and say and attack the person for what he's saying. You don't have to stand up and disagree because most people just don't have the strength to do that.
Maura, your turn.
Yeah, well, I think I actually don't know all that much about Billy Bush, I have to confess. It seems to me that they both sound like jerks on the tape. I can parse between the two of them there. I mean, Trump is making the more boastful and aggressive comments. Again, to me, what I think feels so viscerally troubling to me about it is that this private conversation resonates so completely with his entire campaign, which has been conducted with misogyny, and we should say, and I hope we'll talk about, racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, too, as its tools for rallying its base. So I think he's activating certain emotions in American culture that some of them come from legitimate places. I'm thinking of certain kinds of men who support him avidly or on Twitter. Certain populations have real reasons to be aggrieved. Structural reasons, socioeconomic reasons, but the way that Trump is directing and harnessing that aggrievement, harnessing it into forms of sexist, racist, xenophobic, Islamophobic rage, feel really frightening. And I think for me, both the familiarity of that kind of casual abuse from men and the sense that he's tapping into and activating something very scary in the broader political culture are what just make it quite upsetting to listen to.
Maro,
can I raise a question?
Please, and I want to get to our Muslim angle too.
Yes, it is very disturbing to me, and Maura alluded to this, that what has really lit up the opposition to Trump is his deep misogyny, his talk about groping. We've been hearing for the last year Trump say hateful things about many groups of people. We've also been subject to his displays of incredible ignorance about our system of government, about law, about the Constitution. He's incapable of talking about policy coherently. He wants to jail his political opponent if he wins. I mean, he is an autocrat who would govern, if he governed at all, completely outside of democratic norms. And yet, what we're focusing on is the fact that he's a misogynist. I'm not excusing the fact that he's a misogynist. I understand the visceral revulsion to that. I share it. But it's not really the worst of him.
I completely agree. And I think part of what another sort of sickening and saddening element of that display over the weekend of all these different Republican leaders denouncing him, talking about wives and daughters, was sort of twofold for me. One, it was this, visceral sense that, look, treating women in a demeaning way matters, not because they're your wives and daughters, but because they're human beings. But also this spectacle of, I don't know, sort of activating female victimhood.
Well, you may remember, Paul Ryan said in response to Trump's remarks, women should be cherished. And I remember thinking, no, thank you. Just respect me.
Exactly.
I don't need to be cherished by you.
I want to introduce Rafia Zakaria. She joins us by phone from the Adirondacks. She's a gifted chronicler of Pakistan's history and a keen eye on ours, with a pointedly Muslim-American angle on Donald Trump and the reaction that's still building. Rafia, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
We want to hear this through Muslim Americans' eyes and ears and sensibility after a rough year.
Well, yes, indeed. It's been a very rough year. And I hate to say the fact, you know, that it's, regardless of who wins, it's going to continue to be a rough time for Muslim Americans and for Muslim American women. In hearing Wendy and Maura talk, one of the things that has struck me and that upsets me is that, you know, while there is debate on the issue of, you know, why there is outrage now, you know, whether or not Donald Trump should be forgiven on the part of the GOP, there's still, you know, there's a visible and obvious consensus that what he said on that tape was wrong, to the extent that even he, while it wasn't an apology or anything, he said that he was embarrassed by it. But when it comes to Muslim Americans, there is no such consensus in the United States. I think that a large number of people, not just Trump supporters, but even people on the left, did not raise an eyebrow when Donald Trump announced his Muslim ban in December. To the extent that I remember the CNN commentator, Van Jones, saying, well, you know, with the Muslim ban, I think there might be a legitimate security reason for him to consider that. I remember those words exactly. So the problem then for Muslim Americans is the fact that, you know, there's not even a debate. There's not even, you know, this kind of underlying consensus that they can count on, because there's a great number of people that do think, and even people who will not vote for Trump, who agree with his position on Muslim Americans. So Muslim American women in particular have a double whammy, because not only, you know, would you say that they're subjected to all the issues that Maura and Wendy have pointed out in terms of rape culture, in terms of sexism, in terms of unwanted sexual attention, in terms of inability or environments in which they can't report their persecution. But they have an added layer on top of that of a population that continues to believe that it is entirely okay to suspect Muslim Americans. I mean, I'll bring your attention to, you know, the question that they were, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were asked in the last debate. And while Donald Trump, you know, by the Muslim American woman, and Donald Trump, of course, you know, went back to his position, if we have a problem, et cetera, et cetera. But even Hillary Clinton did not say that, you know, Muslim Americans as a group are not supposed to be suspected. She said that we need their help in picking out terrorists among them, which in essence, you know, reiterates all the prejudices that Americans have. Americans are, they know women. They all have sisters, mothers, and whether or not, you know, we agree with that phrasing, the fact is most Americans are never going to know a Muslim American and are even less likely to know a female Muslim American. So, you know, while we can debate what's going to happen, and, you know, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but I also dread the fact that this rhetoric has been normalized in such a way that even the opponent of the person who is pandering Islamophobia is too afraid to say that Islamophobia is uniformly wrong, that you cannot say that the only way Muslim Americans can justify their presence in this country is by becoming informants for the rest of us. I think that that is a very dire situation, and very, very few people are talking about it right now.
So glad you are on our program, Rafia. Wendy, I mean, isn't it a test really now to broaden this understanding, to broaden the person in lonely isolation here of many descriptions?
It's an opportunity. I'm afraid that we're not going to take advantage of it because Islamophobia is very real. There's a lot of blind anger and fear and prejudice out there, and that is not easily addressed. Muslim Americans are now in a position akin to the position that Japanese Americans were in during the Second World War when they were interned. You know, hopefully it's not going to get that bad, but when Trump called for a ban on Muslims, there was pushback on that, certainly from people who care about constitutional rights, who care about the First Amendment, who care about religious freedom.
Who did push back in a deep, clear way?
You know, I can't name anybody, but I can remember reading a lot about it. And I remember thinking a lot about it and talking a lot about it. You know, off the top of my head, I can't give you any names, but there's been a lot of discussion about it. It certainly has not aroused the kind of outcry that we've heard in the last 2 weeks over Trump's remarks about groping and over his misogyny. I mean, that's absolutely true, and it's very unfortunate. But I just, you know, I wish I had the answer to how we can erode some of this fear and prejudice and bigotry. But I don't. I think it's going to be a long time in coming before we can really come to terms with it.
But wouldn't you say that in itself exposes a vulnerability of our democracy? Because, I mean, if we do not have outcry that we can remember and name when one of the, and Muslim Americans would be one of the smallest minorities of the many minorities that Trump has, you know, excoriated, is that we've already got a terrible democracy deficit, because until it came to the point where it affects, you know, or it relates directly to women or white women, which are a huge chunk of the electorate, there just isn't sufficient marginalization of that discourse. And that, at least to me, it exposes a vulnerability in a democratic system, which is supposed to, you know, safeguard.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are many deficits and many vulnerabilities in our democratic system. We see it in the way the criminal justice system operates. We see it in the surveillance state that grew up after 9/11. We have an extremely weak and vulnerable democracy in many ways, and it is true that at this time, Muslims are in some ways bearing the brunt of it. African Americans bear the brunt of it, certainly in the criminal justice system.
Amen. Moira, it's your turn.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think what's also, I mean, this has been, for me personally at least, such a sort of tricky election to know how to feel about. And I think as a leftist feminist, which is how I would identify, there's sort of no good options to feel good about in some ways. But I think that, and what Rafi is saying seems absolutely right, and what felt so disappointing in a way about the reaction to Trump's misogynistic comments, what was sort of doubly depressing, as I was saying earlier, is the sense that, you know, there are these misogynist sentiments in the culture, and then also that, you know, it's only white female victimhood that people can rally around, because actually it's not so hard for the culture to say, oh, well, women are sexual victims. That's a very familiar kind of idea in a patriarchal culture. And so I completely share Rafia's sense of frustration that, you know, that this other the horrible treatment and discourse about other all sorts of other groups has not evoked the same ire. I think I don't know what we can do other than evoke the ire here.
But
I want to hear from Rafia.
Okay.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think the question, the more crucial question, I mean, you know, we could debate about, I brought it up myself on that the fact that there was no ire, but the future that I'm afraid of is that this discourse, particularly around Muslims, has become a legitimate political position within the American public sphere. It is a legitimate political position in the United States to want a ban on Muslims, to say that Muslims are, in general, worthy of suspicion, of exclusion in some way, of a sort of scrutiny that will not be applied to other people. And so, you know, the question and the debate and the future that we need to plan is how are we going to change that? How are we going to change the fact that this is now a normalized part of American public political discourse?
Rafia Zakaria, we thank you, and we'll let you go. We're challenged and very, very grateful for your contribution. Coming up, more on the intersectionality of the change here. Generations as well as genders, and more. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with Wendy Kaminer and Maura Weigel, and more on the way. In the middle of what feels like a seismic event over the top of the Richter scale, and still impossible to measure, all the tectonic plates in motion, gender, generation, politics, and still questions we got to address about real power and its manipulations through money and law and real advantage in a complex society. Felix Biederman is a left-wing writer and podcaster, still in his 20s, famous in his generation for mocking the radical centrist media establishment, pundits like especially David Brooks of the New York Times. Felix's online radio show is Chapo Trap House. He spoke to me about an intersectional revolution where generation meets and reinforces the gender uprising. Millennials against boomers, with as much conviction as girls against the boys.
There's a generational gap between people who are around my age and people who are around David Brooks's age. Their biggest cultural memory of the last 25, 30 years is 9/11. And that's a lesson that taught them that they have to respect elites and gather around them and that they're elite for a reason. Whereas people my age, the bigger memory is the recession of 2008. These people think that millennials who are just up to their eyeballs in debt and resent the system they've been born into, give a shit what David Brooks says. These people in the media, they think that they're defeating fascism. They think they're defeating Trump, but their influence is far overstated and people's respect for them is far overestimated. But people are more willing to forgive people who voted for a war that caused a million dead and has resulted in a civil war that will probably last past my own lifetime than they are for this guy being a pig in a bus with Donald Trump. It's pretty convenient what we think is forgivable and unforgivable.
That was Felix Biederman. Speaking of New York Times columnists, let's talk about the very best in my time, Anthony Lewis. He wrote less than 20 years ago that greatness in leadership does not depend on sexual propriety. And many good people bought it. I had reservations even then and more now. But here's what he said. He was attacking Ken Starr, who was on the trail of Bill and Monica at the time. Tony Lewis wrote, "Whatever happens at the end of this saga, it is time to stop looking into the bedrooms of public men and women. The country was better off not to know about the sex lives of Dr. King and President Roosevelt while they lived. And it would be better if prurience had not overwhelmed our politics since then." There's been a huge migration of enlightened thinking since then. Can we deal with it, Moira?
I don't know. I feel that there is a difference between, between the two situations that we're comparing here. Again, you know, the tape was private, but Trump makes misogynistic and racist and other kinds of comments in public all the time. It's a key part of his political appeal to his base. So I share the sentiment that it seems regrettable that we're talking about, I mean, there's a way in which the kinds of structural and systemic power issues that Felix was evoking are so much bigger than an individual's sexist misconduct, however odious it may be. But I'm hesitant. I mean, we didn't have to look into his bedroom. He said this stuff on live TV. You know, it's not, it seems a little bit different to me.
I think the differences between the Ken Starr Clinton situation and the Trump situation is that Ken Starr was investigating a consensual relationship. But what the change.
Hugely imbalanced. Who's to say that was really consensual?
I think it is patronizing to suggest that Monica Lewinsky, who was of age, was not capable of consenting to this relationship. Monica Lewinsky was tough enough to stand up to the FBI when they cornered her in that hotel room. I think it is condescending to say that she was not capable of consent. That was, from my perspective, that was a consensual relationship. Trump was talking about something very different. But the other change that we've seen recently is this very expansive notion of sexual assault and a very different notion about the effect of even relatively minor sexual assault on a woman's psyche. And that seems to make the problem much worse than it seemed for women of my generation. We weren't told that we should be traumatized by being groped.
I want to introduce Caitlin Flanagan of The Atlantic magazine. I think of you as a grown-up, Caitlin, who speaks beyond generations. Your big book was Girlland. Your last knockout for me was The Dark Power of Fraternities in the Atlantic, fraternities where a lot of ugly sex on campus is enshrined and protected. State your case about the present. We call it Maelstrom.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting listening to all these opinions, and I think every one of them has been valid and has been interesting. But to me, at age 54, and no one would ever call me a radical feminist. In fact, for some of my opinions, people have even called me an anti-feminist. I don't think I've ever in my whole long life known a woman who did not have some terrible or shameful thing done to her at some point by a man. You know, the amount of just, even if it's once or twice, of just being grabbed or being even assaulted or being even raped, it is such a pervasive element, I think, of the female experience, that it's almost, there's this disconnect. It's between men and women in a certain respect. And I think there are these watershed moments in the life of a culture when women sort of stand up and say, yeah, that happened to me. Something like that happened to me too. Now, to think of it in a politicized way is almost useless. You know, I have to tell you, I believe these women who are accusing Donald Trump, 100%. You know what? I believe the women who accused Bill Clinton. There's just something about sitting. I'm not saying that I'm right about any of this. I'm just saying, as a woman, you hear another woman tell a story and you say, you know what? I think that sounds true. I think there's something about that. You know, I believed Anita Hill. There's just something within women that's beyond politics that says, yeah, this is not a foreign thing they're talking about.
Can I take you, though, to a more maybe darker, more paradoxical place, Caitlin? Mm-hmm. You wrote very affectingly to me that you believed the woman who accused John F. Kennedy of really still hard to digest play in the White House pool, in which he introduced Dave Powers to wish Ted Kennedy were along for the ride with this child from Wheaton College. You believed her, but you also said, and we still love him.
We
in something
love
of the same way we can't take our
men.
Eyes off Trump even now.
You know, Trump I don't love, and I don't really, it's funny, I'm in such a cultural, I don't know, all of us, I think, live in these very polarized cultural places. I'd love to know somebody who's voting for Trump. I don't personally know a single person, you know, so, and I'm sure that there are many Trump people who feel the same way. But there are just certain of these men. I would put Clinton in that basket, and I would put, to use the horrible basket term, there was something about Bill Clinton and something about Kennedy that just they were able to rise above it. And many, many women will tell you, that's exactly the kind of man who abused me. Someone, you know, Trump seems like a guy who would do it. He seems like a real lowlife. You know, nothing about his public life ever suggested he wasn't that kind of guy. And, you know, who's more intellectual than Bill Clinton? He's deeply read, deeply thoughtful, deeply smart man who certainly minded his P's and Q's when he was around a certain kind of woman and certainly took advantage of women who weren't as powerful, certainly knew which was which. But you will find many, many women who say with great bitterness, you know, that guy that everyone thinks is the great guy, the one who's really held up as the incredibly great guy at our college or at our workplace or at our church or at our literary establishment, that's the one who did this to me. So it's almost as though I don't think the two things are in opposition to one another. It's oftentimes the really beguiling, exciting men that women will allow themselves to be alone with.
The political question is are sexual improprieties and even the kind of gross sexual aggressiveness that Trump is talking about, are they by itself disqualifiers for a presidential candidate? As deeply offensive as they are to me, and I share your visceral reaction to them, Caitlin, I don't think it is. I mean, if Trump were not known for his womanizing, if Trump were not so obviously misogynistic and abusive towards women, and if he were running against somebody who we could identify as a misogynist and a really terrible womanizer, but otherwise was a very substantive candidate with a deep knowledge of policy, whose policy predilections we shared, would we vote for him against Trump? I know that I would.
There's another question.
Well, that's
the
heartbreaking reality of it all. You know, the heartbreaking reality is that, you know, Hillary Clinton, and she certainly should have done this. It was certainly within the right thing to do. You know, she stood up and told a jury that a 12-year-old girl had imagined the sexual assault, and that she'd been coming on to older men and was able to get the man accused of raping this 12-year-old girl in Arkansas very long ago, was able to get him a much reduced plea, a much reduced sentence. And that's just the painful, horrible reality of the real world, which even at age 54, you know, I've had people say I'm very childish in my thinking, and I think they're right. I can't accept it. I know you're right. I know I have to hold my nose, and I will vote for Hillary. Of course I will. But to me, there's a real rage in me that women can be violated in this way, and that we say, well, of course, we need to look at the big picture. In other words, I know you're right, but I'm really angry about it. And I think a lot of the things that get ascribed to women as an almost irrational feeling, and men sort of saying, why do they fly off the handle that way? I do think, not to be Freudian about it, but I do think a lot of it is that, God, that's a really big ask of us as a gender, that we should say we're gonna continue our own agenda at the cost of knowing that other women were assaulted.
Moira, Caitlin, Wendy, I'd like each of you to take a crack at what seems to me a huge irony of real power here. As in the famous line from Italy's greatest novel, The Leopard, the line was, if we want things to stay as they are, said the young Sicilian to his powerful uncle, things will have to change. Hillary is the change in appearance, masking, I think, the united power of what means to stay. And precisely the same. Wall Street, old media, the military, shall we say the war party, all the bad habits of a neoliberal empire of money. Moira, would you take a crack at that?
Sure. Well, I think it's funny, as you were speaking, I was thinking of two different things. Maybe they're connected, but I think, you know, in my generation, among millennials who do feel a certain kind of, you know, I'm going to vote for Hillary. I'm going to canvass for Hillary. I'm going to Nevada to do it next week. But nonetheless.
Oh, my gosh, I am too. I'll see you there.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Let's hang out. But I think there is this question of why do we elevate Hillary's not only, it's terrible if they may perhaps if she got someone off for raping a 12-year-old girl. I think people of my generation who have hesitations about her on more structural grounds about finance and power, would say, you know, the worst harm she's done to women had to do with her work on welfare reform or with her hawkishness about the Middle East or, you know, there are other kinds of
look
harm.
Into the Congo. She went to the Congo and said that she would help and the rape epidemic in the Congo. And she ended up, then she came back to the States and gave money to the group that was funding the very forces that were doing the rape. It's like Hillary Clinton is not someone we want to investigate as feminists. We right. need to look at her in a big blurry. And in fact, many women ended up getting lifted out of poverty by welfare reform, which you know, Marion Wright Edelman ultimately admitted to. It's like you have to really hold your nose as a feminist to vote for Hillary Clinton. I'm doing it. I'm not saying it's not it has to be done, but no, the wrong she has done to women may not outweigh the good that she has done for them, but she has done a lot of wrong to women in this country and around the world.
And other yeah. gender persuasions. I mean, it's more than ironic that a victory of Hillary Clinton and a kind of feminist revolution takes the deep power in our country off the hook. No, Wendy?
If Hillary Clinton were not part of and didn't represent the deep power in our country, she wouldn't have gotten where she is today.
That's right.
Look, I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton, but I don't have to because I live in Massachusetts mm-hmm. where my vote doesn't count. I'll vote for Gary Johnson. Now, I wouldn't vote for him if I thought he could become president, but I'm voting for the Libertarian Party. But, you know, politics, power is a dirty, compromised business. It's a lesser evil business. And that's a very hard thing to accept, I think, especially when you're young and idealistic, and it's as you should be when you're young. But, you know, I guess I have low expectations. And Hillary is going to be the status quo. That's true. I mean, except for the fact that she's a woman. But there are many reasons. There are many good policy reasons to oppose Hillary Clinton.
And just to stick up for my generation, I think a lot of young people who get characterized as being, you know, sensitive to trigger warnings or wanting safe spaces are sort of silly, do oppose her on those structural grounds, you know, graduating into a life of eternal student debt and other consequences of Wall Street neoliberalism. I think that people do have sort of robust grounds for their discomfort with her that isn't about sort of a coddled oversensitivity, which I'm not saying anyone here is saying, but I do think is the way that millennials get represented.
But Caitlin, I think I would also remember what Mike Bloomberg said about Hillary Clinton at the Democratic Convention. Let's vote for the person who's sane and competent. We can at least say that about her.
Absolutely.
Also, but still in some way, more of the same. Caitlin, would you speak of it in terms of the lessons of the Obama years, a point of tremendous pride and maybe overwhelming importance to have been the first black president of this country, and yet a time of enormous frustration, too?
Well, I think Ta-Nehisi Coates for The Atlantic wrote that amazing essay called Fear of a Black President. And when it first came out, he was so prescient about it that I thought, oh, are you really right? Has it really gone to this incredible level of racial division? And of course, he has been proven 100% right. And I absolutely wonder, with our first female president, are we in for a time of gender backlash, the likes of which the, you know, late 80s and early 90s didn't even see? I do wonder what's going to happen in these years ahead around gender, having this first woman president. It has been a tremendous unleashing of racism, white racism against blacks at a greater level than I've seen since a child in this country.
Certainly, it's easy to imagine a stalemate continuing forever with the Sanders left and the Republican right. No, Wendy?
Well, we know that if or when Trump loses, there's going to be a campaign to delegitimize Hillary Clinton in the way that there mm-hmm. was a campaign to delegitimize President Obama. We know that if the Republicans maintain control of the Senate, we will have the same degree of obstructionism that we've had for the last several years. I don't believe we have a lot to look forward to. I think it's a very, very scary time. But I think at the very least, if Trump loses, we will have dodged a demagogue.
Moira, the mood of your generation in a few words?
I agree completely. I feel like these are times of like tremendous peril and tremendous promise, because I do think that there's been a certain kind of left energy that feels very utopian. And I think the amount of excitement that there was around Bernie, or there have been around some local candidates, feels very exciting. At the same time, I completely agree and expect that, you know, Hillary will be elected, there will be this terrible blockage, and that it will, you know, that there will be a time of backlash. And so it's hard to know what to make of it. I sort of try to have, a good attitude and low expectations as well.
We're all going to try to stay awake. Thank you, Maura Weigel, Wendy Kaminer, Caitlin Flanagan, Rafia Zakaria, Felix Biederman, and Eileen Miles. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.